is to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Bob Quinn comes from three generations of Montana wheat farmers. So he always assumed he'd be growing wheat too someday. But when he was 16, a chance encounter with a stranger at a county fair set him on a different path.
Well, I was at the county fair in Fort Benton, which is our county seat, just 30, 40 miles from our ranch. Idly walking around and munching on peanuts, I suppose. This old fellow motioned me over and he said, "Hey, Sonny," he said, "would you like some of King Tut's wheat?" I said, "Wow, sure." And so he poured this giant grain right in my hand. I didn't think really much about it until I was in college at UC Davis about 14 years later, finishing a graduate program, and I was eating a package of corn nuts one day, and it said it was made from a giant corn. And I thought, wow, I wonder if corn nuts would be interested in giant wheat. When I called them up in nearby Berkeley at that time, and they said, "Oh, well, yes, we'd be very interested in that." So I called my dad and I said, "Dad, see if you can find some of that old King Tut's wheat." He found about a pint jar half full and sent me a couple of tablespoons. I sent it to them and they did a little trial. They said, "This makes a fantastic snack." He said, "We'll take 10,000 pounds. At a food show in Nuremberg in Germany, I met a fellow from Egypt. He was very interested in this grain, of course, and invited me to Egypt, and I was anxious to go anyway, so we went to the museum in Cairo and looked in the museum where they had the grain out of the tombs, and lo and behold, it wasn't my grain at all. So I was a little deflated by that, and I went to Turkey a few years later, and in Turkey they said to me, "Oh yeah, we know this grain. We call it camel's tooth, or we call it the prophet's wheat." And I said, "Well, I see why you might call it camel's tooth. It's kind of shaped like a tooth, but why do you call it the prophet's wheat? Does it have something to do with Muhammad?" And they said, "Oh no, no, not that prophet." They said, "You know, the one with the boat." "You mean Noah?
Begin the ingathering of all the wild creatures."
"Oh yes," they said, "this is the grain Noah brought with him on the ark.
One young male and female of each."
And I said, "Wow, that's a lot better story than my old tomb story." So that's the story we tell now.
Right. The story he tells now. Well, today, Bob Quinn grows that ancient grain, unmodified and organic, under the brand name Kamut, the ancient Egyptian word for wheat. And in the process, he has transformed more than that family farm. In his book, Grain by Grain, he argues that ancient grain farming can create rural jobs, curb the obesity epidemic, help slow down climate change, and don't even get him started on gluten intolerance.
Come on, wheat is referred to as the staff of life biblically, and it was the grain that built the great Western civilizations of Rome, of the Ephesians, of the Babylonians, of the Egyptians, and now all of a sudden, in the last 50 years, 20% of the people can't eat it. I dare say that 1,000 years ago or a couple thousand years ago, at the height of some of these great civilizations, that problem existed. And I think it's mostly due to how we've changed the grain, how we raise it, how we process it, and how we bred it.
So what has changed in the last 50 years or so?
Well, the focus on high yields. And so the plant has been made shorter, made resistant to plant disease, has maybe more importantly been made so that it can respond to high doses of soluble nitrogen for chemical fertilizers to produce big yields. That's on the farm side. On the bakery side, we've increased loaf volumes by changing the gluten so it can hold more air. so he can make the famous American Wonder white bread. And that bread is lighter and has more air in it. So bakers are able to sell air for the price of bread, essentially. And they love it. They can make more bread with less wheat.
Huh.
And it was a completely surprise, I think. No one intended this, that it couldn't be eaten by so many people. It was an unintended consequence that now is starting to be understood little by little, but more and more.
Yeah. You talked about the loss of nutritional value in a lot of these modern varietals. And you tell this great story in your book about when you were a PhD student in California, I think, you went to a peach orchard and discovered what kind of peaches they were growing there. What did you find out?
Well, that was actually the very first time that I really questioned the industrial chemical agriculture system that I had been taught was just the way it was in the future and the way to feed the world. I don't believe any of that anymore. But what set off my mind a different way of thinking was this visit to a peach orchard where the peaches were being picked and they looked absolutely deliciously ripe with that wonderful blush of a ripe-looking peach, but they were as green as grass. They were hard as a rock. They were more for baseballs than they were for eating. And they didn't taste good, but they had been sprayed with a petrochemical that caused the peach to turn color and look like a ripe peach, even though it was still green. And therefore, they would be able to be picked and shipped in bulk clear across the country without fear of bruising them or handling them one by one the way you'd have to do with a nearly ripe peach. This was looked upon as a great advancement in agricultural production. And to me, it was akin to fraud, actually, because you were pretending to sell something that looked really good that wasn't good at all. And that was the first time I really started questioning what we were doing, even though it was not something, a crop I was familiar with. We don't grow peaches in Montana. But within 10 years, I guess, I started questioning all of the modern industrial ag chemical system.
So this story that you're telling involves so many major institutions, and even kind of ways of thinking. We're talking about, I assume, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, huge corporations like Monsanto, capitalism, the whole capitalist system, the American desire for cheap food. It does raise the question, who is to blame here?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to point blame when people are so easily buying in to the idea of cheap food where they can save money and use it in other ways. I don't know if there's something you can say that anybody's to blame to where we got to, but now it's time when we start understanding that to start looking at change. And if we don't face up to change, then there's a lot of people to blame then. And most of them, of course, the ones that are making the most money are the ones most reluctant to want to change anything because they like it exactly the way it is.
Well, it sounds like you're saying we need a new story here. And I mean, I'm struck by
that. We need education.
Yeah. Well, there's
real education.
You told a great story about your discovery of King Tut's wheat and, you know, how you ended up growing Kamut. And so I guess I'm wondering, what is the story about food? Maybe you would phrase it as education. What's that story that we need to be telling now, the new story that we need to tell?
Well, I think that the biggest way to make change with our food system is to reconnect the idea of health and food, or food and health. Hippocrates taught this 2,300 years ago, that food should be our medicine and medicine should be our food. And if we would reconnect the idea that food is somehow related to health, which is absolutely true, it has everything to do with health, and start thinking in that way, then it would be easier to make some of the other changes that we've talked about and that you've mentioned. Because then you're talking about a real reason to change. It's just not a feel-good thing or the right way to address pollution issues or economic issues or whatnot. But it's something as basic as the health of the people of the country. I think that that would be a driver that could make significant changes that would overcome the resistance to change by these giant corporations.
Well, I am so glad that you are out there, and not just in, you know, voice of despair, but of real hope and possibility.
I'm hopeful. We're going in the right direction. It's still small, but it's a growing movement, and it's where we're headed. I think it's more important to see where we're headed than it is to see where we are, because you can get discouraged a lot of times about where we are. But where are we headed? That's what gives me hope and courage.
Bob Quinn is the author of Grain by Grain. Steve Paulson caught up with him. I'm standing with Robin Wall Kimmerer in front of her vegetable garden. We're in upstate New York, where she lives in an old white farmhouse. You can see her neighbor's big red barn and cornfields across the road. Robin is a botanist and plant ecologist. She lives and works at the intersection of two very different traditions, scientific knowledge and indigenous wisdom. Robin's an enrolled member of Citizen Potawatomi Nation. She can't look at a cornfield or a bean plant without thinking about the history of colonization and genocide, about the deliberate erasure of plant biodiversity. For example, take corn. Robin works with tribal leaders to preserve native varieties of heirloom corn, along with an entire worldview.
Oh my goodness, the corn world. I have been so privileged to see some of the corn archives, if you will, jar after jar after jar, hundreds and hundreds of kinds of corn, from little tiny red strawberry popcorns to great big purple and white flower corns, the dent corns and the flint corns, every color and pattern. It's extraordinary.
And so what's the difference between GMO corn and the kind of heirloom corn that you're planting?
Sovereignty. The heirloom corn of the seeds that were gifted to me by indigenous farmers, that's free corn. And by free, I mean sovereign, independent corn. It's not colonized corn. It carries all of its own genes, first and foremost. It is itself. It is an untrammeled person. In terms of the physiology of the plant itself, it's much more nutritious, has much higher protein, much higher vitamin content than contemporary GMO corn. Tastes better too.
Yeah. It seems like we only have corn because of indigenous scientists, really, who co-evolved it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's a wonderful example of reciprocity between plants and people. Corn made people, and people made corn. They are one of our deepest, oldest relatives. Mm. When we analyze the bodies, particularly of Americans, looking at our tissues, you know, they call us walking Fritos.
Really?
Because, yeah, corn fixes carbon in a particular way that leaves a signature in our own bodies. If we ate only wheat, we would be differently composed. We are people made out of corn, and it shows in the chemistry of our bodies.
I'm really fascinated by the kind of underlying feminine archetypes that are associated with corn. You referred to corn goddesses that are part of creation stories, and the current indigenous movement to preserve heirloom seeds is referred to as rematriation. How come?
Well, for one week, corn is understood as the corn mother. In almost every culture, a corn-growing people refer to her as the corn mother. There's so many reasons for that, but primarily because she takes such good care of us. And when you look at an ear of corn, what makes the corn different from the grasses from which it was domesticated is that every one of those seeds is a baby. Every kernel is an offspring. It's a baby. And they're all wrapped under those blankets. The corn mother cares for her own seeds like a mother. That's why corn is so sacred, that she gives us her children in return for us protecting and caring for those children and planting them again. because part of the magic of corn is that with all those babies, with all those seeds held in that husk, there is no way that corn can reseed itself. There's no such thing as volunteer corn in your garden. It has to be planted, and we're the ones who do that. And that's that closeness. Corn would not exist without us, and in traditional society, we would not exist without corn.
And when you talk about traditional methods of harvesting, there's a phrase, save the best and eat the rest, which means that if you're saving the best kernels, the best seeds to plant, the corn that results is going to carry those long lineages, as opposed to a plant that has been genetically engineered and manufactured in a laboratory. What is that, like in vitro fertilization?
It is. In fact, some of the language by which those foreign genes are put into corn, some of that is the forcible injection of foreign genetic material.
That's rape.
That's rape.
When you look at a field of, I don't know, your neighbor's GMO-modified corn, do you think of that? Do you see rape?
I do. If you just look across the valley, when you see all of those corn plants absolutely uniform, standing in straight lines, shoulder to shoulder, on soil that has been poisoned to kill any other relatives who might be there, that's a really painful thing. Corn, who was always understood by our people as family, as kin, you could only speak of her with animate grammar. She was known as our mother, a sacred being, is now simply understood as an industrial commodity. And that is the colonial worldview, that change from seeing the land as full of life, seeing personhood, intelligence, generosity in the land, to seeing only productive capacity. That is the travesty of the Western worldview manifest in agricultural crops.
It also makes me think it's the same habit of mind that produced slavery.
Yes, in that context, you're exactly right. Which is not to draw false parallels between the tragedies of human enslavement and the treatment of our plants, but it is exactly the same mindset. You're right. And again, it's tied up with the notion of who gets to be a person. Corn does not get to be a person in the Western worldview, just as African slaves did not get to be persons under colonial and slavery regimes.
What is the mental or emotional work you do to be able to walk through a world, look at fields like that, and see both real and psychological violence, a long history of it? You see it more acutely than probably any of your neighbors.
Yes, that is the reality. And that your question and your openness and awareness to that is really important, because the notion of historic trauma, that understanding is alive in the world, but it is ongoing trauma. It is ongoing violence against a way of knowing, and the plants and the other beings, yes. But, you know, at the same time, that means that the privilege of doing this work is all the more beautiful, because it matters so much.
And there's such a hunger in the world right now, because we've been so depleted of exactly what you're talking about, living in a world that's filled with meaning, surrounded by our sacred kin. We are so spiritually undernourished today. So in that sense, you're healing.
And you know, some of the very oldest teachings of Anishinaabe peoples and many peoples around the world are to say that despite land dispossession, despite attempted genocide, despite the boarding schools, despite removal, termination, relocation, despite every single policy in this country that are being replicated around the world to make Native peoples disappear, we are still here. And that is a miracle. That is a miracle. And our elders told us that there would come a time when the whole rest of the world needed the teachings that we had held on to. And that time is now. And to look at a world that is much older, much more morally satisfying, spiritually satisfying, nourishing to the body, to help people understand that it's already here. You tried to make this disappear, but it's still here. It's the seed. The seeds are still here. Our people have been faithful to the seeds of culture, of language, of spirituality. And if you just get out of the way and let them grow, it would be enough to feed all of us.
That's botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer. We talked while sitting under a 200-year-old tree next to her vegetable garden. She lives on a property with butternut trees, a pond, little green herons, and a whole lot of bullfrogs. You can see pictures of us, along with my dog and her neighbor's cat, at ttbook.org. Robin is an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. She directs the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment at SUNY Syracuse, and she's the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. File this under Strange But True Fact. The average American consumes about 4 pounds of corn every day. I know you're thinking, I don't eat 4 pounds of anything a day. Do you eat meat? Most of it was raised on corn. Do you eat anything that comes in a box, a can, or a bottle? Check the label for high fructose corn syrup. There's corn in toothpaste, soap, diapers, drywall, cardboard, ethanol. Americans are pretty much made of corn. And that's a big problem for the planet, because the corn grown in the U.S. requires nitrogen-based fertilizer, a whole lot of it. And that fertilizer is doing serious damage to the environment. But in southern Mexico, indigenous farmers just might have a solution. Reporter Seth Jovag investigates.
About a year ago, a news story caught my ear. Something about a new kind of miracle corn.
New at 6, groundbreaking research could revolutionize the future of Wisconsin's farming industry.
Katie Crowther spoke with scientists studying corn that can actually create its own fertilizer naturally.
What's being done by researchers and students right here in the labs of...
So here's the deal with this miracle corn. First of all, it's not new, at least not to the people of the Sierra Mije region of Oaxaca. Indigenous people have been growing it in the mountains there for, maybe thousands of years. Second, this is some weird-looking corn. It can grow over 16 feet tall. Up and down its stalk, it sprouts roots that look a little like necklaces of pinkish-red fingers. These fingers exude goop. It looks like clear mucus. I like to call it corn snot. This may sound gross, but that mucus is what lets the corn pull nitrogen from the air. And that is amazing.
Initially, I was, to be honest, very skeptical, both excited, but mostly skeptical.
That's Jean-Michel Anet, a Wisconsin agronomist who's been running tests on this corn for a decade now. He was first approached by researchers from the University of California, Davis, and Mars Incorporated, the people who brought you Snickers and Twix. Scientists and farmers had long speculated that this corn was up to something special, but they needed Jean-Michel's expertise to prove exactly what.
Before that project, our long-term target was to be able to get about 10% of nitrogen from the air into corn. And so that was for us our dream. So, yeah.
You hear that? His dream corn would get 10% of its nitrogen from the air. So he had a student run some tests, and he was like, whoa.
That was for us our dream. So, yeah. It was so high that I actually even asked the student to do it many, many times. The same fairly simple experiment, because I was thinking maybe he just swapped a legume sample with a corn sample. It's so high. I was not expecting that at all.
All right, so how high? This corn gets an average of half of its nitrogen from the air, sometimes as much as 80%. Not zero, like American corn. Not 10, like they hoped. 80.
Toxic algae blooms.
Contaminated drinking water.
Dead pelicans.
If there was an FBI most wanted list for major causes of pollution, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer would be on it.
9,000 square miles.
Dead zones in the Gulf.
The same area as the state of New Jersey.
Nitrates in well water.
Alarming number of contaminated wells.
Greenhouse gases.
Fertilizer is contaminated.
It contributes to all that.
40% of pollution.
So imagine if we could cut the need for fertilizer by 50% or more. That'd be a huge deal. Scientists have tried for decades to figure this out. Some call it the holy grail of agriculture. Well, after their research was published last year, I asked Jean-Michel, like, is this as special as it sounds?
It's funny that you're asking that question, because that's probably one of the projects, if not the project, that I'm really passionate about. I was thinking recently, okay, I probably have 20 years of work in science. If I want to achieve one thing, it would be really to put that trait into the hands of growers.
And honestly, he thinks that's doable. In 10 years, maybe 15, maybe 20, this could happen. Okay, at this point, I'm pretty excited about this corn. And then I thought, hey, my old high school buddy lives in Oaxaca, not far from where this corn grows, in fact. I hadn't seen him in years. You know what? I should go. I could reconnect with my friend, talk to a bunch of farmers, see this friggin' crazy giant corn, and make a delightful little story for a public radio program about ancient grains. Let's do this! If only it was that simple.
Well, it's a very comfortable thought. Oh, yeah, the people in Oaxaca, those Indians down there, they can take care of the biodiversity that brought us this commodity.
This is Alejandro de Avila, founding director of the Oaxaca Ethnobotanical Garden. We met in an open-aired office. You can hear the birds. Alejandro cleared off a table piled with posters touting local textiles, promoting biodiversity. He spoke intensely, both hands gently chopping home his points. While he was patient with me, I got the sense his patience in general was running thin.
I feel irony and sadness that people in the States should think with comfort, oh yeah, the people in Oaxaca will take care of conserving the genes that we rely on. Yeah, and the people of Oaxaca are poor. They are dirt poor, and they are being taken advantage of.
So much for my delightful little story.
How nearsighted can you be? How utterly senseless to the human drama that takes place outside of the border at this particular time in history.
Okay, I was starting to get his point. Why on earth would anyone expect the indigenous people of the Sierra Mije to welcome U.S. researchers and a multinational corporation with open arms and zero reservations? Here, have our magic corn. We're happy to help and have no concerns whatsoever that you might someday put a patent on it and sell it back to us in a slightly altered version that we won't be able to afford. We're proud that you can use our corn to solve environmental problems we didn't create in the first place. Buen provecho.
The way this is described by the scientists in Wisconsin is, oh, this is a breed of maize that happens to have that peculiarity. Peculiarity? Bullshit. These are people growing their maize in these kinds of soil, in this kind of climate. It is to them that we owe this. It is not something that happened by chance. This is something that is part of a way of life. It is the way of life of the people of. They have produced this. This is their gift. This is the result of generations of people working, knowing the plants, knowing their local environment. Nowhere is that story given credit to.
In other words, this story about corn, it's not just about corn. Case in point, you noticed two bleeps in what Alejandro said. The first, well, that was a swear word. The second is the name of an indigenous Mije village where the American scientists focused their research. Now, I know the name of the village. In fact, I went there. But the people who live there want the village to be anonymous. To help explain why, I turned to Aldo Gonzalez Rojas, a Zapotec farmer and activist.
Our corn is shared between the communities. Corn is not sold here.
One of Aldo's primary goals is defending the autonomy of indigenous people in this region. And in these parts, autonomy goes hand in hand with farming, with growing your own food.
When someone needs corn here, he goes to one of his countrymen or to the community. In some cases, someone will lend it to him, and when he has his harvest, he returns it. The concern we have is that when universities or companies start doing this type of research, it is not to produce a benefit to humanity, but to have great profits and to be able to do a business. In order to have great profits, they make it so this corn cannot be used by anyone other than them.
All right. Keep Aldo's ideals in your head. Sharing seeds, autonomy, community. Within this context, our bleeped out village in the region signed an agreement with a subsidiary of Mars Inc. The agreement apparently lays out how the village will benefit if their native corn strikes it big someday on the market. It gets the stamp of approval from the Mexican government and an international protocol. But it's also confidential. Now, let me be clear. Aldo doesn't blame the village of for this. His worries are bigger, deeper. There's a long history of indigenous people being dispossessed of land and their way of life. And he's afraid the whole situation surrounding this particular corn will just set a dangerous precedent for years to come. This is his co-worker, Gabriela Linares Sosa.
El tema del saqueo también del maíz por parte de instituciones.
The issue is the looting of corn by academic institutions or governmental bodies. I mean, maize has always been attacked in Oaxaca, including through the permissiveness of government agencies in Mexico that were supposed to be protecting it. The corn is one case, but there are other cases with other types of native crops that are also in the same situation and that are of equal importance for Mexico because they are native.
Okay, deep breath. I went from hope in Wisconsin that this new science could do good in the world to people in Oaxaca who see this in the context of much older problems that have put indigenous people on the defense for centuries. As if to hammer the point home, Aldo sets an envelope in front of me. It's from the United States.
What am I looking at here?
¿Qué estamos viendo aquí?
Este es el maíz Mije.
Oh,
pero lo compramos en Estados Unidos.
What? How did you get
they
this?
They gave there was a, like, they bought this one. This is supposedly the maize that comes from.
Who is this?
¿Quiénes son esos?
¿Están en eBay?
Están en eBay.
Okay. Is that, so is that seen as a, I guess, how do they feel about that?
Parece una pregunta tonta, pero sí. ¿Eso cómo te hace sentir?
Pues dile tú cómo te has sentido, yo le digo yo.
Es una palabra muy mexicana, encabronado.
Encabronado, pissed off. That's how Aldo felt when he learned that seeds from his neighbors were already for sale at $1 a piece on eBay. All right, let's get back on track. I still wanted to see this dang corn. Given the politics involved, I didn't think it'd be right to go combing through random farmers' fields. So a friend of a friend talked to some people, and eventually I was summoned to a Sunday night meeting of the agrarian authorities of. After a long, windy drive through mist-covered mountains, I was in a room with four officials. There's nothing else on the agenda, just me. They wanted to know how I'd heard of them, and I told them. Then I explained what I was working on and said I was really hoping to meet some farmers and see some corn. The meeting was short. With all due respect, they said, no. They asked to make a photocopy of my driver's license for safekeeping and maybe incentive to stay out of local fields. We thanked each other for our time, and in 10 minutes, it was done. Well, this was a bummer. Come all this way to see corn snot, and nothing? But then, just walking down a street on an overcast day in a totally different town, my friend's like, hey, is that it? Okay, it's day 10 or so in Oaxaca, and I'm seeing for the first time maize with gel coming out of its aerial roots. And I'm standing next to a plot where someone's planted maybe 30 plants or so of corn. It's kind of crammed in between a garage and a construction supply store. So yeah, I got to see one. Finally. Man, I went home with my head spinning. I wish I could tell you, here's the bad guy, here's the good guy, but I can't. Yes, one expert told me this was a case of biopiracy. But UC Davis professor Alan Bennett, who led this study from the beginning, insists their work with the Mihe village was well-intentioned and something to be proud of. In Wisconsin, Jean-Michel Annet feels Mars should be applauded for funding a risky project that may lead to a major scientific discovery. Mars is no longer funding the research, by the way. And so far, no one's claiming ownership of the corn snot trait. The research is in the public domain. Matter of fact, I just saw a bunch of it a few days ago at a research plot at the University of Wisconsin. And I hope that's a good thing. I hope this isn't just another silver bullet for the environment that goes astray, another case study in capitalism wreaking havoc on indigenous people. I suppose the test will come in 10 or 15 years, if and when corn snot goes commercial. But meanwhile, we might be missing a much bigger point. In the birthplace of corn, farmers are struggling. And as Aldo and pretty much everybody else I talked to said, that could be bad news for all of us.
Si nosotros vemos las estadísticas a nivel mundial, todavía más del 50% de la producción de alimentos.
If we see statistics globally, more than 50% of food production is still produced on a small scale. It does not depend on transnational companies to survive. That means there are thousands, millions of farmers in the world who continue to do their job to survive. This is very important, because finally those farmers are the ones ensuring that future generations can count on the seeds that they are planting in this moment.
Las empresas no van a garantizar.
The companies are not going to guarantee this. For example, the seed vault at the end of the world in Norway isn't. It's there to take care of the seeds that may be used by companies in the future. But peasant seeds are produced year after year, and they adapt to the new climate conditions. So these are really the seeds of the future.
Our story about corn snot was reported by Seth Jovag, from the Sierra Mije region of Oaxaca and from the University of Wisconsin.
I do have one delightful little story. My trip to Oaxaca included 5 days in the mountains. The Mije family I stayed with dried corn cobs on their roof and saved seeds in sacks or 2-liter soda bottles. I went out one morning with an old woman named Nadia, who was planting beans, corn, and squash, the traditional vegetables of the milpa, on a hillside plot. Nadia would dig a little hole, grab some seeds from a pouch on her waist, drop them in, and cover them up. What she grew on 3 plots like this was enough, in a good year, to feed her family for up to 6 months. Other than manure and compost, no fertilizer required. Later, my friend and I hauled buckets of corn to her house to run through a small electric mill. The resultant masa was cooked on a comal, a big clay griddle heated by a wood fire. The tortillas were, and this is going to shock you, way better than what you get at most stores. Chewy, textured, rich, delicious. Seeing that process start to finish, it felt like an honor. And let's hope it continues for generations to come.
And you want to see what it looked like, don't you? To look at some of Seth's photos from his trip and to read more about the science, just go to ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Climate change, a virus, nuclear war, maybe an asteroid. However the apocalypse arrives, I have a question. For those of us left, what the heck are we going to eat once we've finished all the canned goods? Okay, I'm joking. But seriously, if everything green and growing is at some point decimated by some kind of apocalypse, how are we going to replant anything? I mean, there's a lot of stuff we can live without, apples, oranges, but corn, wheat, rice, they're pretty much essential. Well, lucky for us, somebody else had that thought too, back in the 1990s. His name is Cary Fowler, He's an agriculturalist and the founder of the Svalbard Global Seed Bank, otherwise known as the Doomsday Fault, which can be found 400 feet deep in rock on a desolate island in Norway above the Arctic Circle. That's where they're storing the world's seeds. Charles Monroe Cain sat down with Carrie Fowler and was like, this is crazy.
It was a pretty crazy idea.
I'm just visualizing here either the conversation with your partner or conversation with your first meeting at the UN or the Bill Gates Foundation. And you're like, hey, this is what I want to do. Did you think maybe for a moment it was a little too crazy?
To be honest, in the beginning, I didn't think the right people or enough people would take it very seriously. But I tried to make a pretty strong, rational, logical argument for it. And somewhat to my surprise, people seemed to pay attention and they seemed to go with it.
Well, clearly you did. I mean, you have seeds from North Korea. You've gotten seeds from every country in the world?
Just about. I think the number is up to 234 now in terms of numbers of countries.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that includes some countries that no longer exist, by the way. So.
Wow, I guess you can just keep the seeds, I guess.
Yeah.
I want a little journey with you for a second. You get off the snowmobile in front of the seed vault. People can't see you. What does it look? What do they see? Do they walk downstairs? Is there an elevator? Mm-hmm. What does it physically look like, the building and that's the entrance to the tunnel? Can you take us there?
Sure. Well, it's like a concrete wedge that's sticking out of the side of the mountain. There's a simple metal door there. The Norwegians paid for the facility, paid the cost for it entirely, and under Norwegian law, you have to have some artwork associated with anything that costs that much. It's a beautiful kind of light, artistic lighting feature at the top of the wedge.
It's like a dark blue. It's like a shiny dark blue, right?
Yeah, the artist was fantastic. She said that in the summertime, when you have daylight all 24 hours, you should see your reflection in it, and it should reflect your responsibility.
Oh my God, that's fantastic. You know, oh my God, everything about the sea vault makes me happy.
Yeah, it reflects your responsibility to preserve this natural resource. And in the wintertime, it glows. And as she put it, it's a beacon to mankind.
There's very little sticking out of the ground. It's pretty small that goes into this big, huge tunnel. When I first saw it, it really reminded me of the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Immediately, that's what it reminded me of. And I was like, okay, that's iconic. Then I thought, it's kind of scary, or at least surreal. Is it any of those things, iconic, scary, or surreal?
It's a couple of them.
Okay.
I don't think it's
scary.
Tell me
which ones. Yeah.
It's interesting because it's on a Norwegian postage stamp now, and everybody in Norway would recognize the structure, even though very few people, Norwegians or otherwise, have ever seen it. And the Norwegian government tells me that it's the second most recognized structure in Norway.
Wow, but
even
yeah,
though
of
most,
course,
people
most people haven't
seen
it, right?
Yeah. Once you get down there and you enter a room, you know, I've taken a few people into the room with the seeds, and they've never failed to exit that room with anything other than, I think, an overwhelming amount of emotion. Because when you're in the room with seeds, and we have samples of nearly 1 million different crop varieties.
Wow.
You know, you're in a room with the biggest collection of living biodiversity in the world. So all of these varieties that we have in the seed vault, they are the representation of a 12, 13,000 year history of agriculture on this planet and all of our ancestors. When you think about it, that's a humbling and emotional experience.
I think it's also emotional because one of the reasons you're preserving it is that we may have problems ahead.
Well, exactly. This is a living library of agriculture. And I like to think of it as a kind of like an artist's palette. Let's say in the seed vault, we have 150-something thousand different varieties of wheat and about the same number of rice.
Wow, geez.
And this represents sort of all the colors of the rainbow. So like an artist's palette, it represents what farmers and plant breeders will be able to have in the future for rice and wheat and all the other crops. And if you begin to lose that diversity, if one of those varieties becomes extinct, for example, and you lose those traits that it contains, then you've sort of taken a color off of the artist's palette.
Gosh, this is biblical. You know, I'm picturing Noah with some grains on the boat. Like, I've never heard anything like this before. Does anything else like that even exist or have ever existed on this level of what you're doing?
Not that I know of. I guess there are a lot of different conservation initiatives to conserve a lot of different things, but we designed that facility to last probably longer than any structure that's been built on Earth during my lifetime. And it required the cooperation of a lot of different countries. So it's something that's more or less permanent, or at least it's long-term, and it's for the future, and it's positive. But at the same time, it's a pretty simple idea. This is not really big, high technology, or even very costly, frankly. It's a pretty cheap place to run. It's an insurance policy for agriculture and food security, but that insurance policy probably costs less than the insurance that a major art museum would pay for every year.
And I read you don't even have an employee in there, right? There's not like a watchman or something, right? It's just...
No,
it's empty. There's nobody works there.
That's right. Well, it would be kind of an unfortunate job to have.
Yeah, sounds like a terrible job.
It'd be interesting on the first day, but after that, it would get cold and old.
I have a final question for you, and I don't mean it to be cynical. I'm asking it sincerely. Why should we care?
This diversity is the biological foundation for agriculture. And my definition of extinction is not that a species is extinct when the last individual dies. My definition is that a species is extinct when it no longer has the ability to evolve, because then we're just waiting for the last one to die. And that definition applies not just to the California condor, it applies to wheat and rice. Wheat and rice need to be able to adapt, they need to be able to evolve. Nothing is standing still in the world, and they can't either and survive. So this is the raw material for that evolution. Without this diversity, there is no evolution, and there's no wheat and rice, and there's no food security for human beings. So that's why it's important.
Carrie Fowler is the creator of the Svalbard Global Seed Bank. Charles Monroe Kane was talking with him. These days, Carrie is retired to the Hudson Valley of New York, where he tends an orchard of more than 100 apple varieties. He also keeps a small herd of rare pole cattle and an even rarer flock of Buckeye chickens. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour with help from Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Thanks to Jana Rose Schleiss and Keegan Kyle for Spanish translation this week. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.